It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Kate Archer Kent. Last Friday morning, computers around the world opened up to an error screen that Microsoft users call the blue screen of death.
Around the planet, computer systems crashed, reportedly because of a faulty software update from a cybersecurity company called CrowdStrike. Thousands of organizations, including some U.S. government agencies, rely on their software.
CrowdStrike's update caused widespread system failures affecting local governments, hospitals, airports, and businesses around the globe, including here in Wisconsin.
Taxi companies and ticketing venues had to switch to paper and pencil. Dozens of flights were delayed or canceled at the Milwaukee airport, and health clinics had to reschedule or delay some procedures.
While the outages caused the most disruption on Friday, the ripple effects could be felt through the weekend as IT departments everywhere scrambled to get their computer systems back up and running. Keetron Evans is a cybersecurity researcher at InfoSec, a technology training company based in Wisconsin. Keetron, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you very much.
Yeah, let's start with how this happened on Friday. How could a faulty software update like this at one company have so many ripple effects around the world?
Well, it starts with the fact that when you look at the update that CrowdStrike pushed out, the CrowdStrike product, the Falcon product that they're using and that people are using, has what we call very privileged access to the core or the kernel of Windows. And because of that very privileged access, it's allowed to do things that most software is not able to do. And what happened is when this update went out, there was a faulty, the way it was coded was had a little fault in it. And it essentially tried to write or do something in memory that's not allowed. And when that happens in Windows, Windows just tends to shut down to protect itself. And that's what the blue screen is, and that's what's happening.
And as far as I know, this only occurred on Microsoft operating systems. We did not see this on Apple operating systems or Linux operating systems. But how much of the world is operating on Microsoft, Keetron?
Well, a lot of the world is operating on Microsoft, you know, somewhere 70% or north of that. But the other thing to remember, too, is it's not just the end users. It's the infrastructure like the servers that hold all the data that a lot of us are using, and the servers that decide if we get access to things or not. All those servers, or a lot of those servers, run Windows as well. So when those devices are shut down, it's a multitude of effect, right? So you might have one device that's shut down because of this, but it might affect 20,000 users that use that device to log into the network.
Keetron Evans, it sounds like this privileged access might be part of the problem. Can you explain a little bit more about what this means and where the privileged access rights come from?
Yeah, so this is not uncommon for software like Falcon that CrowdStrike rides out. For example, for it to be able to protect you properly and see those deep, deep rootkits and really advanced malware that gets to that level of privilege by escalation or whatever that malware did, you need something operating at that level to be able to see those things. So it's kind of a necessary evil for the software to be able to protect you in the way that it's supposed to.
But you would expect that this these software updates are tested before they're put out. Why would testing fall short and create not prevent an outage like this that we saw on Friday?
Generally, those updates are tested thoroughly before they're pushed out. But oftentimes, when it's a critical security update, it's a major flaw that's trying to be protected against. Sometimes they may not go through the same rigor that the traditional, more standard types of updates go out through.
So this update came from a company called CrowdStrike and their software Falcon, which had privileged access to Microsoft computers, forcing this update, which caused this outage. What is CrowdStrike? What do they do?
So CrowdStrike provides cybersecurity in the form of what they're most known for is endpoint security and aiding us in responding to incidents. So in other words, every device that's running on your network, you might have a CrowdStrike agent running on there, and that agent is constantly watching every detail of everything that's happening on every device in your enterprise. So when someone tries to attack or when a piece of malware gets onto your device, it knows about it immediately. It can grab it, eradicate it, and report back to a central point that your security people can handle and triage that malware really quickly.
our guest, Keetron Evans, cybersecurity researcher at InfoSec, technology training company based in Wisconsin. And does outage like this that we saw on Friday and over the weekend, does that have the potential for security breaches going forward, Keetron?
Well, it does, because what happens is you have kind of all hands on deck trying to respond to this, right? So if everybody's looking to this thing, trying to fix this, trying to get stuff back up and running, it kind of opens a door for an attacker to kind of slip in amongst all the noise.
Have we seen outages like this before? Some experts are calling it the largest IT outage in history. And what, should we expect to see outages like this in the future?
I think it is probably the largest when you look at the sheer number and the number of companies and organizations affected. And will we see these in the future? I think there'll definitely be some changes in how these updates are vetted before they're pushed out. But I don't think this is a one-off thing. Essentially, it could have happened to any company that has privileged access to your Windows operating system that's allowed to push out updates. So I don't think we've seen the absolute last time that something like this is going to happen.
So I'm curious about some of these ripple effects we saw over the weekend. People stranded at airports, that was a big one. And so how can what may seem like a simple computer outage create so many flight delays, so many cancellations?
Well, so when you look at how airlines work and how the reservation systems and things like that work, we interact with people mostly. We don't interact with the computers at the airport other than just checking into your ticket. But when you try to check in and you can't get your ticket or you can't check in, the first thing you do is you have to go talk to a person at that point. And those people, they're still going to interact with a computer that you can't see. So on the back end of that, it's all being controlled by the same computer network, the same software. And when that stuff goes down, you just can't move forward. You can't move past that point of I made it to the airport. Now I need to check in. You can't get past that point without those critical systems operating properly in the background.
Keetron, what should chief information officers and IT departments be thinking about, be prioritizing following Friday's outage?
I think they should be prioritizing business continuity, disaster recovery, you know, to where you exercise for things like this. When critical systems go down, you have to have a very quick way to restore to a known good state and get things back up to an operational state as quickly as possible. I think there's some lack of preparation a lot of times just because we don't have events like this happen very often. So therefore, we don't prep as much as we should. So I think there should be an uptick in the amount that we do tabletops and we do live exercises to prepare for these types of things.
What about system redundancies, Keetron?
Absolutely. The problem with system redundancy is if you have systems that are redundant to each other, but they both get the update, for example, because it's a critical update, then both your primary system and the redundant system would probably go down. So that won't help as much as it seems like it would, but that's definitely still a practice you should do.
Yeah. So what about, since I mentioned this only happened on Microsoft operating systems, and Microsoft is one of the leading operating systems, the leading operating system, at least in our hemisphere. So what do you think about Microsoft's market share and whether or not, you know, is it dangerous for one company to have so much control over our computer systems?
Well, I think there's always a single point of failure type risk, right? When you have a company that's so dominant like that. But there's also some things that we've gained. There's standardization. You know, most people are comfortable working in a Windows environment. So I think there's more positive to negative to having, you know, the makeup that we have here. But that speaks a lot to maybe diversifying and having alternative ways to do things in your organization.
And with Friday putting this on people's radar everywhere, is there moves that Congress can make? Are there regulations or rules that might prevent this in the future?
I don't know if we could regulate our way out of this. To me, it's one of those things to where we just have to get tighter around how we recover from things like this, because there's going to be blue screens. Systems are going to crash for whatever reason. The fact that that a lot of organizations weren't able to recover or get themselves back to a good operating state in a reasonable amount of time, I think, is a big problem. That's not to give CrowdStrike a pass. Like, there's definitely some failures on their part as far as how these updates are rolled out. And that needs to be looked at a little more closely. And there may be some things that we can do to help them on that. But, you know, I want to be clear here. I'm not recommending that people not use CrowdStrike or not use Windows. I think that that's a little bit immature from a, you know, just from an operation standpoint to try to completely change how you operate based on something like this. But I think on both sides, you know, on the CrowdStrike side and on the customer side, we have to be a little more diligent in how we prepare to recover from disasters like this.
And that's what I'm hearing from you, Keetron, is that we may not be able to prevent it, so the best we can do is prepare for it. But I want to ask, what would it take to prevent outages like this going forward? What could be done to make sure that our systems run without the concern of a global failure?
So I think one thing is, as we look at how we operate today, one of the things you mentioned earlier is redundancy. And just having systems kind of on standby that you can spin up kind of in a crunch to take on the load of whatever your fail systems are. And again, that being able to go back in time, you know, most operating systems have those capabilities now to where that bad file that CrowdStrike pushed out, you should be able to go back to a day before or a couple of days before to where that hadn't happened yet. Now, there's going to be issues with that with things like servers and domain controllers because you can't just go back in time like that without causing an even bigger disruption. But where we can do that, we have to be able to plan for that. And we do have systems in place and we have processes in place to prevent these types of things. I just don't think they were executed on very well. You know, we just weren't ready for this, weren't looking for it to happen.
Hey, Keetron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Mm-hmm.
That was Keetron Evans, cybersecurity researcher at InfoSec, a technology training company based in Wisconsin. He was with us for a look at last week's CrowdStrike system failures and the ripple effects that are still being felt this morning.
Coming up, some pharmacies in Wisconsin and around the country have had trouble keeping Ozempic and related medications on the shelves. That's led to some problems for people dealing with diabetes.
But when you get to 3-4 weeks of interruption, that's when you start not having that much in your system, and then that becomes a problem.
Find out more coming up here on Wisconsin Today. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. Over the last several years, researchers have identified pieces from as many as 11 ancient canoes which were found submerged in Madison's Lake Mendota.
The dugout vessels are among the oldest ever found in North America. But as Sarah Lear reports, the canoes could be just the beginning of what's left for archaeologists to find in the depths of the inland lake.
3 years ago, while diving in Lake Mendota, a maritime archaeologist glimpsed the end of a carved log sticking out from a sand shelf. That log turned out to be a 1,200-year-old dugout canoe. Amy Roseborough is now Wisconsin's state archaeologist. She remembers watching anxiously as a dive team dragged that waterlogged but mostly intact vessel to shore in 2021.
This is something very, very special. I may not have another moment like this ever in my career. This may not be something that Madison ever sees again.
But Madison did see it again. Less than a year later, divers pulled the second, even older canoe from Lake Mendota. Radiocarbon dating placed it at 3,000 years old. At the time, it was the oldest boat ever discovered in the Great Lakes region. That's until this spring, when the Historical Society announced that fragments from as many as 9 other canoes have been found in that same stretch of lake bed. The youngest canoe in the Mendota Cache is 800 years old. The oldest was scooped out from Elmwood 4,500 years ago. Florida still holds the record for the continent's oldest dugout canoe. That one is more than 7,000 years old. Still, curator Torben Rick of the Smithsonian Institution says the Wisconsin Canoe Cache is remarkable.
It's an amazing find. I mean, outside of Florida, I don't know of any place in North America that has anywhere close to this concentration of preserved dugouts.
For Bill Quackenbush, the Ho-Chunk Nation's historic preservation officer, the canoes are a physical manifestation of the tribe's oral history. Those stories describe the tribe's presence in the area since time immemorial.
We didn't survive, you know, thousands of years here. We thrived here for thousands of years.
The canoes, Roseboro says, are further evidence of a millennia-old indigenous civilization in what's now Wisconsin's Four Lakes region. She's sending divers out later this year so they can look for more clues.
Maybe this will show us houses. Maybe this will show us storage pits or cache pits down there, and we can say, okay, here's the village. This is why there are canoes at this location.
After years and years at the bottom of the lake, the canoes excavated in 2021 and 2022 took on the spongy texture of a sopping wet bagel. Now they're sitting in the State Archive facility in Madison, soaking in a waxy substance to preserve their shape. Samantha Sauer of the Wisconsin Historical Society leads the way past heavy doors to the room where those canoes are undergoing preservation. Fans were in the climate-controlled warehouse.
We want to be mindful stewards of all of our collections, and part of that includes security. So you're going to hear beeping throughout the way with our different locks to allow us access.
Eventually, the two boats will be freeze-dried so they can be displayed at the Wisconsin History Center when it opens in 2027. But state archaeologists believe the rest of the canoes at the Mendota site are too fragile to excavate. They'll remain at rest under the water while researchers try to learn more about them using non-invasive methods. That includes working with Quackenbush of the Ho-Chunk Nation to map the depths of the lake with what's known as ground-penetrating radar. A few years ago, Ho-Chunk members recreated a dugout canoe from a cottonwood log. Quackenbush and the state's archaeologists believe they'll be able to shoot radar through the bottom of that boat using a GPR device. And maybe that new canoe will connect Wisconsinites to more of its ancient counterparts. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Since 2022, medications for type 2 diabetes like Ozempic have been in short supply, and it's predicted that shortages will last until at least the end of the year.
The drugs have been proven to be effective for weight loss. That's made them extremely popular, along with aggressive advertising.
Manufacturers like Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly can't keep up with the high demand, and many patients who rely on the medications have been unable to fill their prescriptions.
We heard from two Wisconsin pharmacists about their perspective on the shortage. Here's a listen.
My name is Dr. Hashem Zabak. I'm a pharmacist and a pharmacy owner of Hyatt Pharmacy in Milwaukee. We have been having challenges in ordering some of the weight loss medications. They're also used to treat diabetes. So the manufacturers have not been able to keep up with the demand because of the high demand here in the United States. And some of the patients have had to go without them for a short period of time, unfortunately. Sometimes we try to get it from different wholesalers. If the primary wholesaler is out, sometimes the secondary or other wholesalers might have some. But it's been hit and miss. So in the last few months, there are months when we had really good supply of these GLP-1 agonists, and there are months where we had none and we couldn't get any. The supply has been getting better recently, I want to say in the last couple of weeks, so hopefully this issue will be resolved in the near future.
My name is Nicole Schreiner, and I'm a pharmacist with Strews Pharmacy, and I've been in pharmacy practice for well over 25 years. Drug shortages of the GLP-1 medications used to treat type 2 diabetes have been common in the past few months. However, the supply chain is not the only obstacle patients face in procuring their medications. Most of these medications require special authorization to be covered by insurance, which can delay therapy by days. In addition, PBMs, or pharmacy benefit managers, may require patients to use a certain pharmacy or penalize the patient with a higher copay for not using the preferred pharmacy, even if that preferred pharmacy cannot supply the medication. Pharmacies are also struggling with reimbursement from PBMs below their cost, especially in this therapeutic class of medications. this disincentivizes pharmacies from wanting to fill the prescriptions.
Dr. Lisa Morselli is an assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Endocrinology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. As a prescriber, she has a Wisconsin perspective on the diabetes and weight loss medication shortages. Dr. Morselli, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, give us a brief refresher, first of all. How do these medications, the Ozempics, the Wegovys, these GLP-1 category drugs, what are they actually doing in our bodies when it comes to diabetes and weight loss?
Sure. So these drugs were initially developed for diabetes, and they mimic a hormone that our body makes, that is made in the gut, actually, that helps our body make more insulin. And that's the hormone that we need to process sugar. But then it turns out that this hormone also has an important function by acting on the brain, on the brain centers that control appetite. And so it helps us be less hungry. And that's why these drugs cause a lot of weight loss in most people who take them. And that's why they were then approved also for weight management.
We've got a list of brand names. It seems like that list is growing. Are there significant differences from one medication to another within this category?
So Ozempic and Wegovy are the same medication. It's a little confusing, but Ozempic is approved for diabetes and Wegovy is approved for weight loss. It's exactly the same medication. And then there is another medication in this class called tirzepatide that is marketed under two different names, one for diabetes and one for weight loss. The one for diabetes is Mounjaro. The one for weight loss is called Zepbound, but again, they're the same medication. But for some reason, it was decided that the different indications should have different names, so it is confusing.
Now, I had seen a thing, our colleagues at NPR actually had written up a thing saying, hey, people are having trouble in some cases finding their prescriptions, especially for the diabetes prescribed versions of these. People who need this medication, they linked to a chart where people are reporting, hey, I can't find it at pharmacy X, pharmacy Y, whatever. Are you hearing from people, patients or other people in the profession here in Wisconsin, that some people are having trouble getting their prescriptions filled?
Unfortunately, I do quite frequently. And it seems like things are getting better now, but definitely last year and the beginning of 2024, it was a big problem for many people.
Now, how the way these medications work, as I understand it, Dr. Morselli, and we've talked about this before, is you don't just take them on and off. Once you start, you kind of stick with it for an indefinite period of time, right? So how big a problem is it if somebody had to interrupt, especially that diabetes patient, had to interrupt their medication because they couldn't get that prescription filled?
It can be an issue. It all depends on how long a person cannot get the refills. Because the one good thing about these medications is that they have a long duration of action. And so that means that even if you don't take it for a couple of weeks or 3 weeks, you still have the medication in your system. But when you get to 3-4 weeks of interruption, that's when you start not having that much in your system, and then that becomes a problem. So shorter interruptions are okay.
One concern people had was that, okay, we've got these people with diabetes who need this medication, but uh-oh, here come all these people wanting it for the weight loss purpose, and that's taking away, that's cutting into the supply for people with diabetes. Is that how you see it? Is that how you saw that shortage developing, or was it something else?
So I think that contributed to the shortage because, again, they are the same, at least for Ozempic and Wegovy. Because these were the first drugs in that class that were more potent and were available. And I think that many providers, myself included, initially prescribed whichever one the patient's insurance was prescribed, was covering, sorry, even if patients didn't have diabetes. And so that may have contributed to the shortages for people who have diabetes initially. And I think nobody expected that there would be shortages, especially such long duration of shortages, because we've never operated in this environment. But nowadays, you know, insurance companies are very strict about who can take what medication. So I cannot prescribe a diabetes medication for weight loss in someone who doesn't have diabetes. So I don't think that's contributing to the shortages anymore. And it's just, I think now it's just, it's more a matter of meeting the demand, which is sky high because so many people would benefit from weight loss in this country.
We're talking to Dr. Lisa Morselli, assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Endocrinology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. We are talking about this class of medications, GLP-1 medications. You've heard of Ozempic and Wegovy, same thing. One's for diabetes, one's offered for weight loss, a shortage in some communities at some points in time. Dr. Morselli, let's talk about what goes into a prescription of this medication for different conditions. First of all, let's start with the original use of them that they were envisioned for, diabetes. When would doctors consider prescribing these medications for someone who has been diagnosed with diabetes?
So they are approved for the management of type 2 diabetes. That's the type of diabetes that is associated with having overweight or obesity. And so that would be one setting, one indication for these drugs. And they can, other diabetes medications tend to cause weight gain. So switching from those to Ozempic, for example, can have a lot of benefits for patients with type 2 diabetes. Because in addition to controlling diabetes, they help with weight loss, which has other beneficial effects on health in general.
Let's talk about another category of patients now where a doctor says, okay, the weight alone is a health concern for this patient, but they haven't been diagnosed with diabetes. What goes into prescribing these medications for weight loss for health concerns?
So for the weight loss indication, a doctor should look at a patient's body mass index or BMI, which is the basically a ratio of the patient's weight to their height. It is not a perfect measure of weight status, but the great majority of people who have a high BMI also have a high body fat percentage. And so that's what really we're looking at. And so if your body mass index is above 30, which is the accepted definition of obesity, then you would qualify for injectable weight loss medication or any weight loss medication. And if your BMI is in the overweight category, but you have some weight-related complication like sleep apnea or prediabetes or high cholesterol, high blood pressure, then you would also be a candidate for these drugs.
Okay, now one more category, and I think the perception is there are a lot of people in this category, people seeking these medications for cosmetic weight loss. They don't have the BMI that puts them in that potentially dangerous category. They don't have a diabetes diagnosis. From what you're seeing out there, how many people are seeking these medications in that category?
I think there are people who are seeking this medication who fall in that category. These are not people that I see for the most part, but I think we've all heard about celebrities, and I'm sure there are people out there who really would like to use these drugs for cosmetic reasons, and of course this is not an appropriate reason. We want to... We recommend weight loss for health reasons and not just for cosmetic reasons.
I understand that when people have faced shortages of the regularly prescribed versions of these medications, some have turned to what are called compounding pharmacies. Now, these are intended to say, okay, for this particular patient, we're putting together a particular formula. Do you have concerns about compounding pharmacies providing these medications, versions of these medications outside the usual chain of prescribing?
I do have concerns. I know that compounded medications are accepted are approved or are allowed in the setting of shortages. My main concern is that these drugs are under patent, and so I don't know where the compounded pharmacies or the Medispas that also do a lot of advertisement about these medications, where they source their products. And there is some concern that maybe the compounds that are used to the chemicals that are used to compound these drugs are not exactly the same that are in the FDA-approved drugs. And so we don't really know the safety or efficacy of these compounds.
Dr. Morselli, bringing things back around to diabetes treatment in particular, how important is this class of drugs in helping people live better lives despite having that diabetes diagnosis?
Well, they're definitely a revolution in diabetes management because of their efficacy and because of all the other positive effect that they have on health. So definitely a game changer.
Dr. Morselli, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Lisa Morselli is an assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Endocrinology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. We talked through about the most recent shortage of Ozempic, Wegovy, and other similar weight loss and diabetes drugs. Hey, is this a story that's affecting you as someone who relies on these medications, say, to treat type 2 diabetes? As a physician or pharmacist yourself, love to hear your perspective on this. You could email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, the Green Bay Packers kick off training camp this week, and we'll meet a legendary Packers super fan.
And on the card, it's Mean Gene the Dancing Machine.
Mean Gene joins the show coming up next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Parrott.
And I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. The Green Bay Packers training camp starts this week, and it happens to be the first time in franchise history that training camp opens on the same day as the Packers' annual shareholders meeting.
And one fan is about as excited as they get. Who better to talk about the Packers' past, present, and future than Mean Gene, the dancing machine?
Eugene Mean Gene Greening is a lifelong Green Bay Packers superfan and unofficial mascot of the Clubhouse Live fan podcast. He's been following the green and gold since the legendary days of champion quarterback Bart Starr and head coach Vince Lombardi.
And last year, the National Bobblehead Hall of Fame immortalized Mean Gene with his own bobblehead. I talked to him last week. Gene, thanks for joining us.
Glad to do it.
You've been a fan of the Green Bay Packers for a long time now, Gene. What is your first memory of the Green Bay Packers?
My real first memory, when it really stuck with me that I was going to be a Green Bay Packer fan, is that last play of the game, and I believe that was 1960 in the championship game with the Eagles, and Jimmy Taylor catching the ball, running with it for probably 3 yards, and linebacker, I know his name so well, but forgot it. He tackled Jimmy Taylor. He held him down in the mud and told him, "Now, Jimmy, you can get up because the game is over." But the Packers put out such a courageous fight, and Vince Lombardi says this will never happen again, and it didn't. but when I realized, because I grew up on a farm, and we didn't really have Packers, maybe baseball, but not Packers just 30 miles away, but that was far then. And it's that I can't remember if I even saw that game on the TV or if I listened to it on the radio, but that was just, we should have won that game and like some others, we didn't do it.
Sure. Now, Gene, people may picture nowadays they're watching the game on their big flat screen color TV. Can you talk about what it was like on the farm when you did get to see the TV? What was that experience like?
We had the antenna on top of the house, of course, especially in Milwaukee, if it was in Milwaukee, there'd have so much interference. It totally looked snow on the black and white TV, and you had a hard time seeing who had the ball. I was a trucker all my life, so I listened to lots of games where I was on the road, and many times you weren't able to get a station where you had good reception, and then you're trying to tell by the crowd hollering who had the ball.
Now, how you've been watching the Packers a long time. How has the team, how has the franchise changed over the years as you've been watching as a fan?
Well, the franchise has really changed, of course, where we have the free agency. I don't remember that we had free agency for sure, and we didn't have all this money coming in, and I'm not thinking of the name that we call it, that they share with the teams, salary cap. And of course, the players were not leaving teams like they do now because of the free agency. And I remember for sure, I'm so saddened that I can't think of his name. I'm pretty sure he was a center for the Packers with Vince Lombardi. And this is the kind of thing that took place with Vince Lombardi. And at that time, the player came in. He's in the Hall of Fame. And I believe he's in the National Football Hall of Fame, this player. And he came in and he wanted to get more money. And Vince didn't take long. He said, just a minute. And he left the room. And he came back and said, you're now a Philadelphia Eagle. And the best ending of it all is that, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, whatever, Vince went and got him back. He finished his career with the Green Bay Packers. I'm sure he did.
That wasn't Jim Ringo, was it?
That was Jim Ringo.
Jim Ringo, okay. That's a great story.
Oh, that's how it was. Wish I had met Jim Ringo. Wish I had met Ray Nitschke. Never got to meet them two guys, a few other guys too. But
now, Gene, I got to ask, you seem like a real nice guy. Where did the name Mean Gene come from?
It began with Green Bay Packers Coca-Cola Football Town USA was a contest that they did in Green Bay before they played, I'm pretty sure it was the Dolphins on a Monday night. So my nephew came over. I was outside, told me that this contest is going up at Green Bay and I should go up there and I could win it. And I said, well, what are you talking about? And he knew that I worked with him and his dad on doing tree work. And Gene would always have these cheers that he dreamed up. And I just did it just for fun. And so, I come in and I told my wife about this. And she says, do it. And so it's a story as to how she also was at the game, but not necessarily sitting with me. But she went up there. We were in line. We had to wait. They give us the microphone and you had to do your chair, whatever you did. Well, if you're going to give me a microphone and have me do something like this, I thought I should have a name. So I give myself the name. I did the chair. And the truth of it is you also, one of the gifts of the chair was you'd get to go on Green Bay Field that night and get announced as the winner. Well, soon after my chair, they said, we want these people we call off to come back here and do it again. So they did. I wasn't one of them. And I walked up by the stadium. Here, as I'm going to go in the stadium, this girl taps me on the shoulder and says, you're supposed to be back there doing your chair again. I said, ma'am, the judges didn't pick me as a winner. I'm not in it. She said, you were the best. I said, well, judges are judges. So later on, at Christmas time, here I get this call from the Post Crescent newspaper. We got a press release saying you're the winner of this Coca-Cola contest. And they want to come and do interviews. The newspaper came and did an interview with me. I absolutely couldn't believe it. So because I had won this contest and they're coming out to do an interview, well, I had a big piece of cardboard from a refrigerator I bought in my garage. So I decided to go out there and lay that on the floor and take red paint and put on there, the Vikings suck. So that's part of my stage. See, I set that up. I put rope between two trees and tied it out there in the front. I had a teddy bear that I used to take the Lambo and drag around when we play the Bears. And we had so much fun with that bear. Everybody would kick him around and holler. And, oh, yeah, great fun. And then I had the lions. The lions, I had some of the stuff that they put inside teddy bears, toy teddy bears and what have you. And I had that in my pocket. I said, this is lion guts. and then I found some old grease. And that, and I had that in a laundry soap ripped open container, and that I call Sapp. Remember Warren Sapp?
Warren Sapp from the Buccaneers, yeah, when they were in the division.
Yeah, right. So I had all our competitors covered, and we did the interview with them guys, and so anyway, all the ones Clubhouse Live come along. And the first, wouldn't you know, I was driving school bus and I wouldn't usually get off to be at the show. I wanted to be there 2-3 years ahead. Well, when Jimmy Taylor was coming to the show and being there in person and going to have his book, no matter what, Gene was coming to the show. And that was my first show with Clubhouse Live. Yep.
Talking to Eugene, Mean Gene Greening, lifelong Packers fan. Gene, here comes training camp for the Packers. What are your hopes for the team this year?
Getting to training camp. It's just going to be a lot of fun this year. We're going to win a lot of games. Love. I had full confidence and love from the very start. Naturally, we didn't know. Well, we still don't know, of course, how good Love is going to be. We didn't know that about Aaron Rodgers. I remember when Brett Favre was playing and many fans were wondering because Brett had problems at times with interceptions and losing games. And some fans can't handle that. They didn't go through the 70s. Yeah, and so they wanted to see Aaron Rodgers, and I used to make the comment, Roy Rogers could just sit on a bench until we bring in the horse.
you make a really good point. You've been a fan of the Packers win or lose. Maybe newer fans are only used to the winning time. What is it about the Packers that makes that made you stick with them, even in those lean times?
Well, it was because of the playing of Bart Starr and how he protected the ball and found ways, and of course, our running backs with Paul Hording and Jimmy Taylor, the whole rest of the team. We just had such a team back then, and then, no, we didn't have it. Then it went away because these guys got old. Vince Lombardi went to Washington, and that was a big, bad hurt in my heart to have him do that, and then I didn't even realize it until many years later that Curly Lambeau, with the Packers a couple of times, left us, went and coached the Chicago Bears.
I know.
Oh, pain, ooh, agony, despair. But that all happened. But anyhow, things how the Packers played with all that heart, and you know, these money things that we have now where it's in the game, and it, the heart of the team, and the fact that we had a team that was right here from Green Bay, the only team that was not owned by an owner, but the stock was privately. That's why I was a Green Bay Packers fan.
And I got to ask before I let you go, Gene, I've never had a bobblehead made of me. What is that like to get a bobblehead and it's you?
Well, it's unbelievable how much I've seen other bobbleheads of players there, how they made it look so much like me. Incredible. And it truly does. And then to have people buy the bobblehead. I have two of my doctors that had me sign the bobblehead. Yes, my regular primary doctor and my dermatologist both bought bobbleheads. Who has doctors like that?
Gene, it's been great talking to you. Enjoy the season.
We will. I could talk for hours, you know. But so good that you cared about calling me, and go Pack, go.
Eugene, Mean Gene Greening is a lifelong Green Bay Packers super fan and unofficial mascot of the Clubhouse Live Fan Podcast. Do you have high hopes for the Packers season this year? Make your predictions. Let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. And do you have a bobblehead of you? I don't. Let me know if you do. Love to see it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
On Sunday, President Biden announced he will not be seeking a second term and is stepping down as the Democratic Party's nominee. The decision has upended a presidential contest that once seemed destined to be a rematch of just 4 years ago.
While we're watching for what this means here in Wisconsin, we want to know what President Biden's decision means to you.
What was your reaction to the president dropping out of the race? Does this change the way you see your vote in November? And what are you hoping to see next in this presidential contest?
Tell us about it. Call or text at 888-642-0232. That number again, 888-642-0232. You can also email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
We'd love to hear your thoughts and share them on an upcoming show.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Farron.
And I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.